It is 28 minutes after the hour, a therapeutic Thursday going on here at Broken Road Radio. And joining us now from Ashburn, Virginia, Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie's an Anglican priest, actually, so you can envision him, if you like, with robes and a large kind of... No, that's a St. Patrick's Day thing on his head right now. It's got 2 4-leaf clovers and a lot of green fuzz. Thank you for that image, Robbie. That really.
Hey, you're welcome. I'm here to serve, here to help. Great to be with you, Jim and David.
Robbie, the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, and it looks to me like you sent me this marvelous story from Bible History Daily on the Siloam Pool. Archaeology is our topic today, and does this mean that you're lecturing on archaeology on Sunday?
Well, yeah, we're covering the blind man at the Pool of Siloam, so you can't necessarily talk about this account, which takes up the entire chapter, 9th chapter of John, without talking about the archaeology surrounding the account. I mean, it's archaeologically rich, the context of
this. It's just strange that it sat there for 2,000 years undiscovered. Think of all the people that have walked and driven over the top of that, even some looking for it, perhaps. And it's kind of discovered by accident. Somebody spots 2 steps, and they say, "Oh, let's dig that up." And they did. And what a marvelous find!
Part of the problem is they had thought that they had the particular site around 300 A.D., the Byzantine era. I guess it was a little bit later than that, a Byzantine era church over what they thought was the Pool of Siloam. And multiple sites had been built and torn down and built over this particular pool at the end of Hezekiah's tunnel, channeling the Gihon Springs in the old city of David, the Ophel. And this is the same water system. I mean, the history of this biblically goes all the way back to David.
Well, and Hezekiah's tunnel wasn't discovered until fairly recently either. So that was all this part of the same archaeological survey?
Well, multiple. Warren, who dug Warren's shaft, who discovered some of this, and as well as the towers that are surrounding and guarding the Gihon Springs. So basically, when the Assyrians were attacking the north around 722, King Hezekiah was fearful that the Judea, specifically the Temple Mount complex around the Jerusalem, the city of David, would also be compromised, and he did not want any outside invaders to have access to the Gihon Springs, which could prolong a siege. So,
well, that was the water supply for the city, was it not? Or at least it was after his tunnel was dug.
Exactly. It was actually that was the water supply for the city even before the tunnel was dug. The issue was that water supply was at risk. It was exposed. It would have also been the water supply for the invading armies and enemies surrounding the city. It was a security breach, basically.
Hence the towers at the springs themselves. And so it brought basically water underground into the city to be protected during any lengthy siege. Siege warfare is something else, and that was the mode of the day, and was for 1,000 years, at least into the Crusades. It was still siege warfare. This makes, this is an important part of context. I mean, these were not silly people existing in a book someplace. They were living day to day, trying to protect themselves, trying to survive in what was a very violent world. And with the Assyrian army on the outskirts, how long does the Bible tell us how long it took to? Are there clues in there as to how long this? Because this is not that tunnel is fairly lengthy. I mean, digging that at that period of history. I mean, there were no drills, no power drills. You know,
it's an engineering feat, and I've walked through it. It's 1,750 feet long.
So, 3 football fields.
It's through solid limestone. There's actually a Canaanite tunnel very close to the entrance of Hezekiah's tunnel that dates back to the era of the Canaanites.
So they tried to tunnel in. Now, I understand it, and I don't know why, where this comes from. I must have read it, but Hezekiah had teams at either end working together.
Correct.
Trying to meet in the middle. What a trick that would be over the length of 3 football fields.
and do that without GPS and satellite imagery and you know, X-raying the Earth and all of the things that we have access to for engineering purposes to design and lay out and tunnel. I mean, it really is. It's an engineering feat.
We should never sell them short, these people, on the genius and intellect of these people. Sometimes we just dismiss them. But when you look at what they accomplished with what they had to work with, I mean, there's some astounding feats of art and architecture.
And not only that, I mean, 2,700 years later, you can go walk through it, and water's flowing through it today. It's an amazing little tunnel. It's pretty phenomenal.
Once again, there's a link to the picture. I mentioned this to listeners this morning. If you scroll up a little bit, you'll see a link to the article at Biblical Archaeology, at their website, and it'll click you right to a picture of the Siloam Pool. Now, it's not just, I mean, and it's pretty sizable too, 225 feet, they estimate, in its day, and it was a place for healing and maybe for ritual baths and maybe for water supply. I guess historians are still kicking all those ideas around, but it's where Jesus healed a blind man. And that's what, I guess, makes this site so significant to us. Now, and in describing your picture, I mistakenly referred to the Chosen and Jesus' healing of the cripple. That was at a different pool, though. That was at the Bethesda Pool, which is up north at the northwest extreme of the wall around Jerusalem. The Sheep's Gate is up there. So I was in error. The Chosen TV show shows that and does it very well in context, by the way. And whether they treat the blind man, I don't know yet. So,
well, you're right to couple these pools, because John's gospel is the only gospel that mentions the Pool of Bethesda or Bethsaida. It's near the Sheep Gate. It's north of the temple. Siloam is south of the temple. And both of these particular archaeological finds of these two pools have been recent. You mentioned already that Siloam, which means sent, we know that from the text, gives us the context that the Pool of Siloam, the name there means sent. So Jesus sends this man to the pool called Sent. But John's gospel is the only gospel that mentions these two pools. And because of their ambiguity, it's actually these two sites in particular, these two pools, the references have been used to discredit John's gospel until, of course, in 2004, as you mentioned, this pool of Siloam was discovered. And that was not a long time ago. And because this particular pool has steps going in on all four sides, it's not 90-degree angles. It's an odd-shaped pool, but it is about the size of a football field. Mm-hmm. And so this actually validated what people had been saying all along, that hundreds of thousands of people would come to Jerusalem for Passover. And the critique was always, that can't be possible, because there's not enough mikveh or ceremonial washing baths for pilgrims to purify themselves before ascending up to the Temple Mount to offer sacrifice. On the southern steps of the Temple Mount, there are mikveh there, mikvod, many of them, but not enough for hundreds of thousands of pilgrims. That, coupled with the idea that the pool in the north of Bethesda, which, by the way, your confusion is merited, because in verse 3, it says that in these pools lay a great multitude of sick and blind. So that's John 5:3. So there are blind people at Bethesda as well, amongst the lame and the sick there. But these two pools, the five-porched pool in John 5 and Siloam, which again, a little teeny pool that they had thought they had found. And then, of course, in 2004, to dig up these stairs and to realize this is a huge pool with stairs on all four sides, which potentially means this is a mikveh. And I'm actually of the school that this is a mikveh, as well as the southern pool, also formed the northern pool this by
because it's fed by a spring, there would have been moving water, which was a requirement for a mikveh, right? It couldn't be just a pool, that's a dead pool, a puddle. It had to be moving water, living water, as they would say.
Yeah, that's the way to say it, living water. And then you get Jesus's reference at what we talked about last week with the woman at the well, and this reference to, if you knew who was asking you for water, you would ask him for water. He would give you living water, a wellspring welling up to eternal life. So living water is required. So this water can't be carried by hand. It has to come in or flow in from the rain or a natural source such as a spring. And we have a spring, the Gihon spring in the south, and we have a spring in the north. This John chapter 5 pool was also constructed by Hezekiah. Hezekiah built a dam, creating the northern pool, and that was living water. And at the Second Temple period, during King Herod the Great's reign, he built another dam in the south, creating not one but two pools, and then built five porches. These pools have been excavated around St. Anne's Church, north of the Temple Mount, and they have stairs into them as well. This becomes very important when we're understanding this account of the man born blind. There's a whole chapter dedicated to it. Jesus spits on the ground. He makes mud, and this actually makes the blind man impure. Already, the Jewish people think he's impure because you can hear it in their questioning. Mm-hmm. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?
Yeah, this was offensive to them.
Exactly, because he has to be a special kind of sinner to have been born blind. Mm. And so you get echoes of Job's stupid friends ridiculing him, you know, go ahead and confess your sin and die. Certainly you've done something to offend God that all these bad things are happening to you. And that's the Jewish worldview that the disciples are even holding to when they say, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents? But Jesus's answer, neither this man nor his parents, but that the glory of God might be fulfilled. And then he spits on the ground. He makes the mud. We know that part of what makes a person impure is any kind of bodily fluids. Mm-hmm. We also know it's the Sabbath day when Jesus does the healings at both pools. And Jesus does something to break the Sabbath other than the healing itself. Pay attention to what he does, spitting on the ground. We know at this time that the Jews had added and compounded the complexity of the law, defining what does it mean not to work on the Sabbath. And the Jewish leaders and the rigid legalistic Jews said that if you spit, and the spit comes out of your mouth, it dents the ground you're plowing. So you're breaking Sabbath.
My goodness.
So Jesus not only heals a blind man, but he plows, apparently. He's breaking the Sabbath law. Also, what's illegal on the Sabbath is carrying your mat on the Sabbath day. Hmm. In John chapter 5, Jesus says, do you want to be well to this man who's been here for 38 years at this pool? And he says, I have no one to put me into the pool. And Jesus says something fascinating. He says, pick up your mat and walk, get up. And the man carries his mat into the temple complex, breaking the Sabbath, calling attention to the fact that Jesus broke the Sabbath when he healed this man. Mm. And so these are two parallel accounts sandwiching the temple in the middle. So you got the furthest south and the furthest north barriers of the temple, or the city walls, sandwiching the temple in the middle. It's almost like Jesus is assaulting the purity laws and the Jewish system of the day by approaching these two people in particular and healing them on this particular Sabbath.
This is a great example of how context serves your understanding of the Bible. I mean, we read over this and okay, spit, okay, and I read, all right, ooh, yuck, okay, all right. We did, but the people of the time, as they heard this in John's account, would have been shocked.
Yeah.
He spit? No.
But then the other piece is, now he's got spitting and mud in his eye. Mm-hmm. And mikvahs are not for washing. They're for purification. So what does Jesus tell the guy to do? Go to the pool of Siloam, which means sent. He sends him to the pool called Sent, mm-hmm. and he tells him to wash in the pool. He could have just said, just go down there and you'll be healed.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just wait till tomorrow and you'll be healed. But no, he instructs him to wash, which now puts spit and mud in the mikveh in front of everyone who know him as the blind man.
Mm-hmm.
They understand that this man, I mean, consider it, if he's born from birth and he lives in the city, then everyone knows him as that man who was born blind, that particularly sinful man. So Jesus sends him to this pool to do a prophetic action, I would say, to undo the legalistic religious system. He disrupts their entire ritual purity, and really no one's being sent from this pool other than up to Jerusalem to offer sacrifice. But we are called to be a sent people. We are called to be lights. The Jewish mm-hmm. people in particular were called to be a light to the Gentiles. But if you look at this whole thing, how did the man get down there? We know, by the way, in some of the arguments about this pool, when some of the scholars said this has got to be a mikveh because of the stairs around it, someone else said it's too far from the southern steps of the temple. By the time the pilgrims would get up, they would be impure if they climbed the Temple Mount. So another archaeologist said, well, let's keep looking, because if we found the pool, there's got to be a dedicated street. And they actually found the street. And I've walked up that street to the Temple Mount underground in a tunnel. Mm-hmm. And you can do that today as well. And you can step those steps, particularly, which I believe could have been the very steps the blind man used.
Well, if Jesus, I'm wondering if Jesus had that in mind to go wash in the pool, that that was a ritual bath then. I mean, it did the ritual cleansing of him after this event. So he could go to the temple then if that was his choice.
Yeah, but we find out what happens next. I mean, it's such a large account. I mean, it's the entire chapter. And we see that this particular man becomes an evangelist to the Jews. And so we just got finished with, you know, John chapter 3, Nick at night being, you know, secret disciple of
Nicodemus,
Jesus.
Nicodemus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then he's actually going into the Sanhedrin and bearing witness and defending Jesus in John chapter 7. Then you've got the Samaritan woman at the well. She's an evangelist to the Samaritan people. We talked about her a little bit last week.
Who would be considered Gentiles.
Yeah, and then if you go back a click and look at what you bring up with Bethesda, which I 100% know that these two accounts are intentionally linked in John's gospel for an intentional purpose. You should look at them together because they're both on the Sabbath day, they're both mikveh, and they're sandwiching the temple from north to south. So Bethesda first in the north, then Siloam in the south. And so these two pools are tied. In the north, you've got this man carrying his mat as a walking billboard to everyone on the temple complex that Jesus has healed him and told him to carry his mat. And in the south, you've got a blind man literally saying to the Jews, do you want to be his disciples? You're asking me mm-hmm. so many questions. One thing, you know, I don't know where he came from, but if he's a sinner, sinners can't do works of God like this.
They even interviewed his parents.
Yeah.
Pulled
and how
them
about
into
that?
Him, so.
Have your parents throw you under the bus. He's of age. Ask him. They approach the parents and say, is this your son who was born blind? And they do not answer the question. They do not come to their son's defense. They say, he is of age. Ask him. That's not untrue. It's kind of like with us. You know, we're to care for our kids.
See, that response alone tells you they were thoroughly intimidated by the whole experience. Yeah.
And they didn't want to get kicked out of the temple system or not be able to go to the synagogue. And so they are guarding their religious idol of place and practice where this man is already banned because he's a special kind of sinner. He's born blind.
God didn't like him, so neither do we. That kind of attitude.
But now he sees, and he's right there. And you're right. I guess if it's a mikvah and he can see already, and now he's pure, but you got to get in the mikvah, and the text doesn't tell us he does that.
That's true.
Just that he washed his face. But he could have jumped in. We don't know. But he completely offends the Jews around him. Hmm. And it's a heated debate. And he's not messing around. This blind man says to this Jewish elite, you're asking me so many questions. Do you want to be his disciples? Do you want to? And they say, we're disciples of Moses. You're his disciple. And they get irate. And they cite Moses as their discipler. And we're his disciples. We're disciples of the law of Moses. And, you know, to their answer, you know, who is this that did this? He goes, I don't know, but one thing I do know. Once I was blind, now I see.
Now, Jesus was there having gone to Jerusalem for a feast. I don't know which one from the text. Can you tell? Would this have been Passover, or it could have been Sukkot? It could have been a number of other events. I get the season. But I'm wondering where in his ministry this happened, because he's getting pretty intense here. He's making his presence known to the people who are eventually going to crucify him. And he's proving to them that they got to do something, step by step by step by step. It's an amazing process. And this has to be an important event, or John wouldn't have devoted a chapter to it. Now, granted, he didn't write in chapters, but he included it in his work for a reason. So we need to attach probably heavier significance to this than some of the other things we read.
Absolutely. And if you look at particularly at John chapter 5, the text actually says that it's in this moment that they set out to kill Jesus, that this man is carrying his mat, that he's broken the Sabbath, that Jesus has commanded, not only healed the man on the Sabbath, but commanded him to pick up his mat on the Sabbath, that at that moment, because Jesus says, rise up, take up your bed and walk. That's chapter 5 of John, verse 8. So rise, take up your bed and walk. And immediately the man was made well. He took up his bed and he walked. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, it is the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to carry your bed. He answered, he who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk. And they said to him, who is this man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? But the one who was healed did not know who it was. But Jesus finds him later, and he says, see that you sin no more. This is the other connection. In John chapter 9, neither this man nor his parents sinned that he was born blind, but in John chapter 5, see that you sin no more, lest something worse happen to you, indicates that this man is crippled and lame because he is a sinner. So, is it possible that we have infirmities, brokenness, handicaps because of our sin? The answer is yes, absolutely.
Well, I'm wondering, this is a bit of a devil's advocate question. He was crippled, and he was a sinner. So does that mean that the condition of being crippled was payment for his sin, the price for sin, or were they two separate ideas?
Yeah, and in this case, it is. But I'm going to be real careful here because I want to say two things. Number one, bad things happen to bad people. Bad things happen to good people. The Bible says it this way, it rains on the just and the unjust alike, meaning God blesses, showers down a blessing. Rain was considered a blessing. My crops are going to grow. I'm going to eat today. It rains on the just and the unjust alike. In other words, God blesses. Good things happen to bad people, and good things happen to good people. It's not always the case that we are crippled because of some sort of sinfulness or blind or have some sort of infirmity. But it's certainly the case, and maybe you know a story like this. For me, I know a particular young man who went out drinking and driving, and he got in an accident. He lost his leg. Had he not been intoxicated while he was driving, he would not have lost his leg. That was a direct consequence to his sinfulness. Mm. And so we can make direct links like that that we know about. We don't know this particular person's story. But we do know from John chapter 9 that it is not the case for every handicap, every infirmity, that it's somehow sin that brought it about. Sometimes it's so that the glory of God might be revealed.
That was something I just wanted to point out, because there's a difference in the circumstance of each of these two people.
Yes.
Both serve to highlight, to expose, to show the glory of God. Was the blind man blinded for that reason? I mean, is this like a long-term... that kind of loses me, that maybe God made him blind so that later on in his life, God would be glorified. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you formed me in my mother's womb. We got Psalm 139 here. Mm-hmm. It would have happened, had to have happened in his design from the foundation of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting into predestination.
Yeah.
And a pretty huge topic of, how does God design us? And does God design intentional flaws into us, or is that a part of the fall? Can God use something for his glory post-fall? And I would say yes.
Yes, that I have no problem with that.
Yeah. So in other words, if somehow in a broken, genetic system, you're predisposed to be born blind,
mm-hmm.
God is going to use that for his glory. It doesn't mean he did it.
So sin is our general condition, not necessarily the specific cause for a specific malady, but it puts us in a vulnerable position from the get-go.
Mm, yeah.
So we can be victimized by sin without having sinned directly.
Mm, exactly. Mm. Now, with this man who did sin, Jesus shows him in John chapter 5, he lavishes him with an undeserved grace. If we know this man's a sinner and he deserves what he's got here, which is the case with this man,
well,
Jesus
this is a cripple,
goes out of his way to go to this pool to heal him specifically, and he's secretive about it. If you look at this this particular account, he has to be so nonchalant, because this place could be potentially the northern pool, the first pool built, could be an Asclepius for healing, a healing ritual pool. It could also be the northern pool, a feeder pool for the religious mikveh in the southern pool. So I think he's at the northern pool.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason the waters are turning is the water flow from the northern pool to the southern pool, because there are valves in the dam. You can go there today. Mm-hmm. It's been excavated. They've excavated the dam. So I think he's at the northern pool. He has to be quiet about it, Jesus does, because if he heals this guy, he's going to have a mob.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't heal anyone else but this guy in particular. Notice what happens in verse 18. It says in verse 18, therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, referencing Jesus, because of this account. So Jesus is sentencing himself. He's giving the religious elite ammunition to kill him by doing this healing in this particular way, at this particular pool, on this particular day, asking the guy to pick up that particular mat and go walk through the temple.
He's engineering his own death.
This is Jesus' design, that he's going to waste no sinner's plight, no brokenness, without bringing about his glory and purposes, even his own unjust death for our life.
Robbie, it's been something else here. When he can tie archaeology into, it just completes the big picture for us. And I hope listeners appreciate that fact. And again, if you want to start with a little archaeology this morning, that link is in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com. You can see the story of the Siloam Pool, how it was discovered and uncovered, and Then go read in John about both those. And Robbie has his four-leaf clover green fuzzy thing on his head. St. Patrick's Day tomorrow, I guess, huh?
Yep. Okay.
I wonder if that's where the, you know, that healing at Siloam, if that's where the old phrase, here's mud in your eye, comes from. It's a good thing. Yeah, I think so. Robbie is the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. Their website, preservingbibletimes.org. There's a great big obvious link to it on our website at Broken Road Radio. You want to go there and study what they have to offer there. It's all centered on context in the Bible. It helps you read what's between the lines, much as what Robbie revealed for us here in our session today. Robbie, thanks so much. Appreciate having you around. We'll look forward to next week. Okay?
Pleasure to be with you, Jim and David. Godspeed. Have a wonderful week.
Much thanks, Robbie.